You don't want militarized people in the streets just roaming around, snatching people up, many of which turn out to actually be U.S. citizens that just don't have their papers on them. Are we really going to be the Gestapo? Where's your papers? Is that what we've come to?
Yes, that's what we've come to, Joe Rogan. Just like we tried to warn you back in 2024 when you were getting the guy elected, you jackass.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internet around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast, because things are going to get weird this year. Get weird, I can already hear you saying out there. Yes, they are going to get even weirder than they already are, as the reality of Trump being a loser headed toward electoral confirmation of his loserness later this year begins to set in more and more for him and, yes, for his supporters like Joe Rogan. Really? Are we going to send out the Gestapo? Yes, Joe. That's what happened. That's what mass deportation means. But by weird, I mean both weird as things are now, for sure, but even more so in the days ahead, and dangerous as they are now, but also certainly even more so as he becomes Donald Trump here, as he becomes more and more desperate to head off or otherwise distract from his weirdness and his loserness. And he starts, you know, looking for fresh people other than himself to blame for it.
Good point.
So let's, hi Desi Doyen.
Hi.
Let's start here. Let's start here today. Grocery prices are rose at the fastest pace in 3 years, as Axios reports today, based on new numbers out on Tuesday from the federal government's Bureau of Labor Statistics, keeping pressure on household budgets even as overall inflation largely held steady in December, remaining almost exactly where it was when Trump was elected in November of 2024. It's down about half of one-tenth of a point from where it was under President Joe Biden at the time. The jump in grocery costs, however, one of the most immediate and visible gauges of the health of the economy to consumers who visit one of those old-fashioned grocery stores. I know it's an old-fashioned term, but you probably heard it because Trump made it popular again by using that word, groceries, and explaining what it means during the 2024 campaign that Joe Rogan was so impressed with. Rising prices highlight the challenge for the White House in the lead-up to the midterm elections. Inflation relief, such that there has been any, is little consolation for Americans if they are not seeing it reflected in their grocery bills, notes Axios. Grocery prices rose by 0.7%. They rose from November in the month of December, the largest monthly gain since the peak inflation period back in August 22, as global supply chains were a mess and corporate price gouging was in full effect while the world attempted to come out of the COVID pandemic. Food inflation was evident at restaurants as well as grocery stores, according to the new BLS report. Costs for dining out rose by a similar amount, the largest monthly gain in 3 years. Overall, grocery prices were up roughly 2.4% in December as compared to the prior year. To make that plain, grocery prices were 2.4% higher last month under Donald Trump than they were a year earlier under Joe Biden. Despite Trump's election promises to lower grocery prices on day one, he didn't. They are up, not down, after nearly a full year of his presidency. But even that number masks double-digit price increases for a slew of household staples over the past 12 months, including coffee, which has gone up 20%, beef up 16%, candy, I guess that's now a household staple, that is 10% above what it was 1 year ago. President Trump rolled back some of the tariff taxes that you pay on imports as originally enacted by him on a whole bunch of household staples late last year after his new taxes had spiked prices, but those prices are still up on most of those items nonetheless. Overall, beyond just groceries, prices are up even higher. The consumer price index rose 2.7% in the 12 months through December, while a key gauge excluding food and energy costs, those that rose by 2.6%. So if you throw food and energy in, it gets you to 2.7% inflation over the past year. Trump, because I told you this was going to get weird, though in this case, predictably so, he praised the figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which included the three-year record increase on grocery prices. He praised it on his failing social media site, calling them, quote, great low inflation numbers for the USA. Sorry to bore you with numbers and Bureau of Labor Statistics data there, but I thought you deserved to know what the real numbers are, given the way that he will be and already is lying about them, hoping to mislead you in his attempted election year Jedi mind tricks.
And I wonder if corporate media will be covering the increase in consumer prices, since that was something that they were super obsessed about during the Biden administration.
Well, there's a lot to cover these days, because things are going to get even more weird as the year progresses, I'm afraid, as Republican members of Congress who aren't quite as deluded as Donald Trump, as they begin to take actions necessary to try and save themselves. We'll get to some of that shortly. And as the courts continue to reject Donald Trump, at least the lower courts, if not necessarily the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, though that could change as well. We'll see. In the lower courts today, Trump has continued to be a loser of late. A federal judge ruled on Monday that the Trump administration acted illegally when it canceled $7.6 billion in pre-existing clean energy grants for projects in states that voted for Democrat Kamala Harris in the 2024 election. Yes, it is illegal, it turns out, to use federal funding to punish your political enemies, as most non-losers probably already knew at this point. The grant supported hundreds of clean energy projects in 16 states, including battery plants, hydrogen tech projects, upgrades to the electric grid, and efforts to capture carbon dioxide emissions. Good luck with that one. The Energy Department said the projects were terminated after a review determined that they did not adequately advance the nation's energy needs or were not economically viable. Russ Vogt, the White House budget director, said on social media that, quote, the left's climate agenda is being canceled. Well, that probably did not help the administration's case in court when all of this was challenged. U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta said the administration's actions violated the Constitution's equal protection requirements. Quote, defendants freely admit that they made grant termination decisions primarily, if not exclusively, based on whether the awardee resided in a state whose citizens voted for President Trump in 2024. That from Judge Mehta in his 17-page opinion. The administration offered no explanation for how their purposeful targeting of grant recipients based on their electoral support for Trump, or lack of it, quote, rationally advances their stated government interest, according to the judge. Because, of course, it doesn't. It should also be noted here that in Trump's attempt to punish so-called blue states by raising their electricity prices and making their air dirtier and their people more sick, he was also punishing his own voters, including in the state, with the most Republican voters in the nation, more Republican voters than any other, which is
California.
That's right, California. So, hey, California Republicans, you know who have to thank. Projects were canceled in California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, Oregon, Vermont, and Washington State. All 16 states that were targeted supported Kamala Harris in 24. A Texas hydrogen project and three state projects in West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, which all voted in 24 for Trump, they were spared from Trump's tirade, his childish tirade, and so far his failed attempt to punish blue states. Trump said in an interview last fall with a right-wing outlet that his administration could cut projects that Democrats want, quote, "I'm allowed to cut things that never should have been approved in the first place." As it turns out, according to the federal judge on Monday, no, that is not actually true. The general counsel for the Environmental Defense Fund, one of the groups that filed the suit, said the court ruling, quote, recognized that the Trump Department of Energy vindictively canceled projects for clean, affordable energy that just happened to be in states disfavored by the Trump administration in violation of the bedrock constitutional guarantee that all people in all states have equal protection under the law. Ann Evans, the CEO of Elevate Energy, one of the groups that lost funding from this, said the court ruling would help keep clean energy affordable and create jobs, noting, quote, "The restoration of these grants is an important step toward making that possible." The ruling was the second legal loss for the administration's efforts to undermine clean, cheap, renewable energy programs in a matter of hours on Monday. A separate federal judge earlier on Monday ruled that work on a major offshore wind farm for Rhode Island that serves Connecticut can, in fact, resume, handing the industry at least a temporary victory for now as Trump seeks to shut it down, to shut down all the windmills, as he likes to say, in an effort, in this case, hoping to punish those blue states. But, of course, also hitting millions of his own voters in the bargain. More on that Rhode Island matter in Desi's latest Green News report a little bit later this hour.
Yep.
As noted, Republican-led Congress is also taking notice of their incredibly unpopular loser president and taking actions to try and begin to save themselves before this November's midterms. As the New York Times reported last night, Congress is racing to undo thousands of cuts to federal science programs that Donald Trump called for last year when planning the government's current budget. If enacted, the president's bid for an overall cut in scientific funding to $154 billion from $198 billion, that would be a plunge of more than 20%, well, that would have been the largest reduction in federal spending on science since World War II. Those cuts have been a big part of Trump's Project 2026 agenda, as I'm sure you all heard about all last year, as week after week he announced one cut after another. Doge, you know. Well, this week, the Senate Appropriations Committee released a bipartisan package of bills that largely scraps all of Trump's planned cuts. By and large, analysts say that if the proposed budgets hold up in the weeks ahead, Congress will set aside roughly $188 billion for federal research of science, a drop of about 4% from the most recent annual budget. So not 22% as Trump and the White House were assuming, but just 4%. Quote, "That's pretty solid," said Alessandra Zimmerman, a budget analyst at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Quote, "Congress is really starting to push back," she observed, according to the Times.
Good.
Good indeed. Surprisingly, analysts foresee a possible rise, of more than 2% in the budget category known as basic research, which produces fundamental strides and spin-offs in fields like healthcare and artificial intelligence, according to the Times. Last year, the Trump administration called for a cut in federal basic research of more than one-third, so more than 33%. Instead, looks like there might be a rise of 2% for that. The call that Trump made is apparently not being answered, at least not by the U.S. Senate, as they race to pass a federal budget before the government faces another looming shutdown. Yes, at the end of this month, at the end of January. Trump sought even larger cuts for the National Science Foundation, where which sponsors much of the nation's basic research. He actually proposed that its budget be slashed to $3.9 billion from $8.8 billion. That would be a drop of 56%. But the Senate package countered with a reduction of less than 1%.
Good.
Remember, beyond Trump's weird fantasies that he is a king, it's actually Congress. It is not the president or the White House, which ultimately has the constitutional power of the purse. Although Trump will be free to shut down the government again with a veto of Congress's budget if he doesn't like it. But that, you know, always plays very well in an election year when the president shuts down the government. The bipartisan accord on funding science in the Senate, Zimmerman said, stands in sharp contrast with the congressional impasse that shut down the government last fall as Democrats and Republicans clashed over the renewal of subsidies for the Affordable Care Act. Quote, "They're working together now," she said. "It's a return to normalcy," which, of course, is also weird, if true. Yes, a return to normalcy is now weird in this country, and we'll see how much they're working together. They still haven't renewed the subsidies that were cut to the Affordable Care Act, but we will see. In a statement, Senator Patty Murray of Washington State, the top Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee, praised the package of bills as good not only for investigating nature, but also for enhancing public safety and the welfare of American families.
Indeed. I mean, the federal government science funding, science research funding, has been an economic engine, not just for the U.S., but also for the world. I mean, it has advanced energy, technology, medicine, public health, like Senator Patty Murray mentioned, all of that since World War II. It would be suicidal and self-defeating to cut that
both
kind
literally,
of
literally, in many ways, economically, to do that. No, exactly. And the Senate seems to know that, especially now that we are in an election year. Patty Murray said, quote, "Democrats fought to protect investments that matter." She said the package, quote, "rejects President Trump's push to let our competitors do laps around us." Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine and chair of the Appropriations Committee, she called the package, quote, "a fiscally responsible move that will," quote, "spur scientific research necessary to maintain U.S. competitiveness." Well, no wonder that Trump is calling on his voters now to vote against Senator Collins this November. Keep that in mind, Trump voters. He wants you to vote against Senator Collins. Write that down. The Senate package includes $24.4 billion for NASA, which is a fairly marginal 1.6% cut, $8.8 billion for the Environmental Protection Agency. That's just a 4% cut after all of the targeting at the EPA. The Department of Energy Office of Science will see just a 1.9. Well, actually, we'll see a 1.9% increase at the Department of Energy Office of Science. NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, their budget will remain roughly flat.
Good.
The U.S. Geological Survey will see a 2% cut, and the NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, will see a 2.3% increase in their funding under the Senate package. All of that, those, you know, sort of marginal cuts, is largely what we would expect from any run-of-the-mill Congress controlled by Republicans in the pre-Trump years, and that's what we seem to be seeing now from Republicans there. On Thursday, the House voted to approve the Senate package. So barring a veto from Trump, this could end up being a done deal. And that's a big deal. But, you know, so as not to be too happy about all of this, the Times notes that the improved budgetary picture cannot undo the damage that Trump administration, his frenzy of budget cutting and administrative chaos has brought to the nation's scientific establishments, what with all the firings and everything else and just chaos. Stop this program, start that one. As an analyst see it, they worry that the cycles of cuts and reinstatements will take a toll that in some cases may require years to mend. Well, yeah, it's going to take years, but let's get to the mending part, shall we? Analysts also note that the administration has made policy shifts on how appropriated funds are actually spent. For instance, the National Institutes of Health, which traditionally hedged its scientific bets by supporting a wide range of investigators, is now dividing its annual budget into fewer projects. Even so, the Times notes science advocates are reportedly breathing sighs of relief now that Congress is re-embracing the status quo in the last century powered status quo that in the last century had powered the nation's rise and now maintains its status as a world leader in scientific discovery. Quote, science is doing okay, said Ms. Zimmerman of the Science Association. She said, things are not bad at all, given our expectations. You may, by now, already have heard of several other incidents over the past several days where congressional Republicans are finally beginning to assert themselves, finally beginning to turn, in some cases, directly against Donald Trump now that we're in an election year. And more Republicans are beginning to realize that being too closely aligned to Donald Trump is a losing strategy, as voters will finally have their own say about all of this in November. The Senate last week, with 5 GOP defections, voted to block further military action in Venezuela. Trump blasted the 5 defectors by name, saying that, quote, they should never be elected to office again, including, yes, Maine's Susan Collins, who's up for a difficult re-election this year, and on whom GOP control of the Senate could well hinge. But as I noted, for the Trump supporters, write that down. He does not want you voting for that Susan Collins. She is no good. Vote against her, even if you have to vote for the Democrat in Maine this year, says Donald Trump. The others who voted to stop further action against Venezuela under the War Powers Act include Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, Kentucky's Rand Paul, and a lot more surprisingly, both Missouri's Josh Hawley and Indiana's Todd Young, neither of whom is up for re-election this year. Those two votes on what was a procedural vote on the War Powers Act to bar Trump from taking more action against Venezuela, that would be enough if they vote the same way on the bill's final passage, I think this week, I believe, to adopt the resolution. 52-47 is what the vote was last week, as all of the Senate Democratic senators voted for it. Another Republican did not vote at all. It was unclear who that was, but a war powers resolution does not need 60 votes to pass in the Senate. It just needs, in the 100-seat Senate, it just needs a bare majority, which it appears to now have. It would have to also pass the House where the margin is so currently so slim there that Republicans can afford to lose just one vote on any issue. If they lose two votes and all the Democrats are present, well, the Democrats would win that vote. Whether Mike Johnson allows this matter to to even come up for a vote, that remains to be seen. Though we have now seen three, maybe four different bills come up for a vote and receive passage, including the Epstein files vote, thanks to a so-called discharge petition. If it's signed by a majority of House members, well, that forces a vote, works around the House Speaker, who normally gets to decide what will and won't come up for a vote. Here, even if the House voted and adopted this War Powers resolution along with the Senate, well, the president would still need to sign it, thanks to a 1983 ruling by the Supreme Court, which changed the original attempt by Congress.
Of course they did.
Even back in 83. Back then, the original intent was to allow a joint resolution by both chambers of Congress to stop a war, to go into effect without a presidential signature in case it was that president who started the war. Still, what is happening in the Senate right now on this matter is a clear sign that Trump is losing his, well, what was his ironclad grip on his caucus in the Senate. And, well, over in the House last week, over objections from both Trump and Speaker Johnson, lawmakers passed a clean 3-year extension of the Obamacare subsidies that Republicans cut off last summer in their so-called Big Beautiful Bill. But with health insurance premiums now skyrocketing for tens of millions of Americans, Democrats, with a discharge petition, they were able to work around Johnson to get their bill to the floor for the extension of these subsidies. 17 Republicans defected from the from their party to join the Democrats to vote in favor of it. That measure will still have to be adopted in the Senate for the billions of dollars in health care subsidies to be restored. And a 60-vote majority is required to pass that one in the 100-seat House. So there's still a difficult road there. 100-seat Senate, thank you. But 17 Republicans defecting in the House, that would have been unthinkable, frankly, just weeks ago, it seems to me. So, yeah, we are now in an election year, and things are going to get weird in both bad ways and good ways. Here is one more, well, weird way. First, it was the now-retired Marjorie Taylor Greene who turned on her idol, Donald Trump. Now it's Colorado's Lauren Boebert, who is seemingly growing a spine to stand up to Trump, maybe, sort of, or at least act like she is, at least on the Epstein matter, and now on this new one last week. So Boebert, together with her Colorado Republican colleague in the House, Congressman Jeff Hurd, and the support of both of Colorado's senators, who are both Democrats, they had managed to get a non-controversial bipartisan water project bill for her rural constituents in southeast Colorado unanimously passed in both the House and the Senate last year, only to have her dear leader suddenly decide to demonstrate just how petty and vindictive he could truly be, as if we didn't know, by issuing the very first veto of his second term to this measure. Trump is taking his retribution out on the people of Colorado, denying them clean drinking water to block this bill that had passed unanimously in both houses. And by the way, the jobs that would go along with it. All because he's mad that Colorado won't pardon disgraced, imprisoned former Mesa County election clerk Tina Peters, who tried to help Trump steal the 2020 election by breaking into her own voting machines in the middle of the night. And, of course, because Boebert signed that discharge petition to force a vote on releasing the Epstein files last year. So he vetoed the measure to finish the Colorado Water Project just before the end of the year. That did not go over well with Lauren Boebert, who had some unusually choice words in response directly to Trump and his veto. She wrote, quote, President Trump decided to veto a completely non-controversial bipartisan bill that passed both the House and Senate unanimously. Why? Because nothing says America first like denying clean drinking water to 50,000 people in Southeast Colorado, many of whom enthusiastically voted for him in all three elections. I must have missed the rally where he stood in Colorado and promised to personally derail critical water infrastructure projects. My bad. I thought the campaign was about lowering costs and cutting red tape. Well, that is your bad, Lauren Boebert. She continued, but hey, if this administration wants to make its legacy blocking projects that deliver water to rural Americans, that's on them, she said. I'm going to continue fighting for Colorado and standing up for rural communities, our farmers, and every family that deserves safe, reliable drinking water without decades more delay. Good for her, I suppose.
Yes, Colorado. Southeastern Colorado needed that water pipeline, and it's good of her to speak up and say so.
Even passive-aggressively. We'll take it. So what now becomes of that bill, H.R. 131? Well, as Denver's KDVR noted, Congress rarely overrides a presidential veto. They've done so just over 100 times with some 2,500 vetoes by sitting presidents. According to the congressional website, conversely, it's nearly unprecedented for a president to actually veto a bill that had a voting rating of 100-0 in the Senate and 435-0 in the House. The Congress website had no instances of that recorded in its database. But in fact, last week, the House held its vote to override the presidential veto, which requires a two-thirds supermajority to do so. While the measure received the vote of every Democrat, just 35 Republicans had the courage to vote to override the president. So while the measure passed 248-177, it failed to reach the 288 votes that would be needed to override Trump's presidential veto. So there's still a whole bunch of cowards in the U.S. House. There were, however, 35 Republicans who were willing to vote against Trump in the House. That ain't nothing compared to what we have seen over the past year. All 35 of those seats, of course, will be up for re-election this year, and I suspect most of the folks in those seats know it well, and they're beginning to vote like it, with even Lauren Boebert seemingly beginning to notice what a cretin she has thrown in with all of these years. In the meantime, hey, sorry, Colorado, Trump has vetoed your clean drinking water. You'll have to wait for federal funding for clean drinking water until it's added to another legislative vehicle in the future, I guess, or until you free the criminal election fraudster Tina Peters, who is still serving her 9-year sentence for election fraud, no matter how much Donald Trump wants her to be free. So, yeah, things are going to get a lot weirder as more elected officials come to terms with the fact that this is an election year when they will be on the ballot and Donald Trump will not. In fact, he will never be on the ballot again. More weirdness ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Don't you think it's weird?
Really weird. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, more chaos and weirdness out of the Trump administration this week and into today with members of Trump's own cabinet now, at least somewhat turning against him, at least reportedly. A perturbed Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, told President Trump late Sunday, according to Mark Caputo, an excellent reporter over at Axios, that the federal criminal investigation into the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, quote, made a mess and could be bad for financial markets. That is according to two sources familiar with the call, telling Axios. Bessent's worries about the financial fallout were somewhat realized, in fact, on Monday when the dollar dropped as bond yields and the price of gold rose amid worries about political interference in and stability at the Fed. Quote, the secretary, Secretary Bessent, isn't happy and he let the president know, said one source familiar with Bessent's call to Trump. And frankly, the fact that someone close enough to the situation who knew what was said on that call told Axios about it, well, that is also not a great sign for Donald Trump. Sunday night after the call, as far as I can tell, Trump subsequently appeared to distance himself from the investigation of the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, for allegedly misrepresenting the cost of renovations to the Federal Reserve's headquarters in D.C. And, you know, Donald Trump is worried about, you know, running up costs for construction from his $450 million ballroom. He hates to see those cost overruns. In any event, Trump has long been mad at Powell for not lowering interest rates fast enough for him in hopes of juicing the economy, even if, as the Fed fears, it would result in skyrocketing inflation once again. On Sunday night, Powell, who was originally appointed as Fed chair by Donald Trump in his first term, though Trump would later lie about that and try to claim that he was a Joe Biden appointee, Powell released a very rare, very weird, almost hostage-like video statement in which he denied any wrongdoing and accused the Trump administration of politicizing and, yes, weaponizing the Justice Department because Powell hadn't supported lowering interest rates as much or as quickly as Trump wanted. According to Powell's video, quote, the threat of criminal charges is a consequence of the Federal Reserve setting interest rates based on our best assessment of what will serve the public rather than following the preferences of the president. Well, how dare he? Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, a key member on the Senate Banking Committee, vowed to block any action on Powell's replacement because of this DOJ investigation and said that the department's credibility is now in question after former Fox News host turned Trump's U.S. attorney in D.C. headed up this criminal probe of Jerome Powell. Standing up for an independent Fed, Tillis, who is retiring
yes.
instead of running for re-election this year, said
he found a spine when he realized he was not going to run
correct,
again.
Correct. He said, but he's still there until next year. He said, quote, I will oppose the confirmation of any nominee for the Fed, including the upcoming Fed chair vacancy, until this legal matter is resolved. Bessent's concerns about the investigation aren't reportedly only rooted in the financial markets. According to Caputo's sources, Powell's term as chair ends in May. And the administration was hoping that he'd step down sooner after Trump nominated his replacement. But though Fed chairs often leave the Fed after they end their term as chair, Powell is actually scheduled to continue serving for two more years through 2028 if he wants to on the Board of Governors. So now he may never leave, at least until then. And he'd still be there to vote against what Trump wants the Fed to do. Either way, he almost certainly won't now be leaving early, even if Trump announces his replacement as his term as chair would end in May. Quote, now Powell is dug in. This really made a mess of things, said one of Axios's sources. A Treasury spokesperson, of course, denied all of this to Axios, which likely means it's completely true. More bad decisions by Trump and the Department of Justice are now coming back seemingly to haunt him and them today. At least six leaders of the Justice Department unit that investigates police killings have resigned in protest over the administration's handling of the fatal shooting of 37-year-old mother Renee Good in her car in Minneapolis by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer. That, according to three people briefed on the departures, as MS Now reported late last night, top leaders of the criminal section of the DOJ's Civil Rights Division, six of them, have now left their jobs to register their frustration with the department after the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Harmeet Dhillon, a right-wing election fraud fraudster and activist who was tapped by Trump to lead the division after she decided not to investigate the ICE officer's fatal shooting of Good last week. The criminal section of the division would normally investigate any fatal shooting by a law enforcement officer, and it specializes in probing potential or alleged abuse or improper use of force by law enforcement. And remember, these were people who had not left so far. These are people who were willing until now to tolerate Dhillon's decimation of the section and bastardization of the civil rights unit. But this apparently was the final brick in the wall for them, I guess. The departures include that of the chief of the section, as well as the principal deputy chief, the deputy chief, and acting deputy chief. They represent the most significant mass resignation at the Justice Department since last February. Back just days after Trump had taken office, five leaders, you'll recall, and supervisors at the department's public integrity section resigned rather than comply with an appointee of Donald Trump's orders to dismiss the bribery case against then New York Mayor Eric Adams. Five left at that time, now six left on Monday night. Last week, the FBI announced it would be handling the investigation of Good's shooting on its own. They blocked Minnesota authorities from their typical role in reviewing evidence and investigating the shooting themselves, and potentially bringing murder charges against ICE agent Jonathan Ross, who killed Good with three virtually point-blank shots as her car was moving past him. If he is tried and convicted on state murder charges in Minnesota, well, he can't be pardoned by Donald Trump. And these folks who left DOJ were not happy that the state was being shut out. The state is trying to get in anyway, so we'll see. I think that story is not over, but that's not all. After six top DOJ prosecutors resigned over the Civil Rights Division's refusal to investigate the shooting on Monday, six more prosecutors, these at the Minnesota field office, resigned on Tuesday, according to the New York Times today. Six federal prosecutors in Minnesota resigned on Tuesday over the Justice Department's push to investigate the widow of Renee Good. The Trump DOJ won't investigate the murderer, but they want to investigate the wife of the woman who was killed by him. Joseph Thompson, who was second in command at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota and oversaw a sprawling fraud investigation that has roiled Minnesota's political landscape, was among those who quit on Tuesday, according to three people with knowledge. Thompson, a career prosecutor, objected to the approach they were taking in Minnesota, as well as to the Justice Department's refusal to include state officials in investigating whether the shooting itself was lawful. The Minneapolis police chief, Brian O'Hara, said in an interview that Thompson's resignation deals a major blow to efforts to root out rampant theft from state agencies, which Trump has used as a pretext for his ICE assault on Minneapolis, really meant as a retribution against Governor Tim Walz, who ran as the Democratic vice presidential candidate in 2024 against Trump, and, of course, against the voters in Minnesota. Quote, when you lose the leader responsible for making the fraud cases, it tells you this isn't really about prosecuting fraud, said Chief O'Hara. The other senior career prosecutors who resigned include Harry Jacobs, Melinda Williams, and Thomas Calhoun Lopez. Jacobs had been Thompson's deputy overseeing the fraud investigation, which began back in 2022. Under the Biden administration, Calhoun Lopez was the chief of the Violent and Major Crimes Unit. They are all now out. Becca Good, Nicole's wife, said in a statement last week that she and her wife, quote, stopped to support our neighbors when they got into a tense confrontation with ICE agents that led to the shooting. Quote, we had whistles, said Becca Good. They had guns. Thompson strenuously objected to the decision not to investigate the shooting as a civil rights matter. He was outraged by the demand to launch a criminal investigation into Becca Good, according to people familiar. Thompson had originally set out to investigate the shooting in partnership with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the state agency that reviews police shootings, but senior Justice Department officials overruled the decision to cooperate with the state agency. Drew Evans, the superintendent of the Bureau, called Thompson's departure a major setback for the effort to root out fraud in the state and for public safety. Evans said, quote, we're losing a true public servant. We really need professional prosecutors, he noted. Well, so much for Trump's claim that he's actually bothered by the fraud concerns in Minnesota. The absence of a credible and comprehensive investigation into Ms. Good's killing stands to, quote, undermine trust in our public safety agencies, Mr. Evans of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension noted.
And, of course, the whole country loses in the case of these prosecutors resigning. We lose highly principled litigators, we lose institutional memory, and we also lose an ethical work culture.
The loser Donald Trump's response to all of this amid 12 prosecutors resigning from the DOJ over the administration's response and or attempted cover-up. And growing protests and outrage against the shooting in Minneapolis and across the nation. What's his response? Well, another wackadoodle post on his failing social media site, naturally. Trump threatened Minnesota with, quote, a day of reckoning and retribution. In all caps on Tuesday, he accused the state's state Democrats of weaponizing the ICE shooting of Renee Good to distract from widespread fraud that he argues they have long abetted in the state, and the prosecutors of which apparently just quit. Not in response to Democrats, as it turns out, but in response to the Trump administration. Now, I usually don't like to read from his social media posts because they are so nuts and disinformative, but this one is so nuts that it demands that I share at least part of it. Quote, do the people of Minnesota really want to live in a community in which there are thousands of already convicted murderers, drug dealers, and addicts, rapists, violent released and escaped prisoners, dangerous people from foreign mental institutions and insane asylums, and other deadly criminals too dangerous to even mention? But he wrote on his social media platform. Weird. I don't recall seeing any of that when, you know, visiting the lovely Twin Cities area a few years ago. It was great. And it didn't have thousands of militarized federal goons roaming the streets and shooting into residents' cars or smashing their windows or doors. Quote, in all caps, fear not, great people of Minnesota. The day of reckoning and retribution is coming, he added. No, that's not weird at all, is it, for the president of the United States? Minneapolis, of course, has been rocked by protests to all of this in the days since the shooting of Renee Good, with Democrats, including Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, urging federal law enforcement to leave the city after what they have done. Though Mayor Frey, I think, put it more succinctly.
To ICE, get the f*** out of Minneapolis.
Yep. In a social media post later on Tuesday, Walls said that Trump's statement was proof, quote, that this is nothing but political retribution. As he had argued, quote, Minnesota voted against him three times, and now he's punishing us, putting lives at risk and wasting enormous resources in the process, wrote the governor. And his law enforcement officials at DOJ in D.C. and in Minnesota, they're all now ghosting him in the bargain. They want nothing to do with that retribution. As I said, things are getting weirder by the day. Expect more in the days ahead. And, of course, in our Green News Report. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help Desi Doyen and I stay on your public airwaves. You're the only one that keeps us here. Thank you. Okay, it has been a big, weird day.
Yeah,
more to come in our latest Green News Report.
Hundreds of structures have been destroyed, and more than 390,000 hectares of land has been burnt since the middle of last week.
Australia battles record heat and extreme bushfires.
What the world loses is a key player who has the economic power to phase out fossil fuels in a meaningful way.
Trump withdraws U.S. from bedrock U.N. climate treaty. Plus, Trump EPA will no longer consider lives saved when calculating the cost of pollution rules.
Well, what's a human life worth anyway? We've got data centers to build. All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We have not approved one windmill since I've been in office, and we're going to keep it that way. My goal is to not let any windmill be built. They're losers.
Much like yourself, sir. All right, not fair to windmills. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, this time of year, it gets cold around these parts, but not down in Australia.
No, sadly. In Australia, where it is currently high summer, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has declared a state of disaster in the province of Victoria after one of the most extreme heat waves in years resulted in intense bushfires that have destroyed hundreds of homes and killed at least one person. The extreme heat has also killed thousands of flying foxes, a species of Australian bat, in the largest mass mortality event on record. Here's Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
We've got your back, not just during this crisis, but through the recovery as well. And we'll work cooperatively with the Allan government to make sure we deliver what is necessary so that people and communities can get back on their feet.
It is the same thing year after year after year down there in Australia these days.
Yes, it is. But at least the Prime Minister is working with the provincial government, unlike in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
At a White House meeting late last week, Donald Trump pressured U.S. oil executives to spend tens of billions of dollars to repair Venezuela's petroleum infrastructure, saying he will decide which oil companies get that privilege.
Because some of them don't want to go at all.
Exactly. On Monday, Trump said he might exclude oil giant Exxon after Exxon's CEO said that Venezuela is, quote, uninvestable without major security guarantees.
Unbelievable.
In a huge gift to the polluting fossil fuel industry, the Trump EPA plans to stop considering scientifically determined health benefits in its cost-benefit analyses that are necessary for clean air regulations. EPA instead will only calculate the cost to industry. That's according to internal documents obtained by the New York Times. The stunning reversal would increase industrial pollution and make it easier to overturn long-standing clean air and water rules that have dramatically reduced pollution-related deaths and illnesses. Environmental law experts say the move defies U.S. Supreme Court rulings and the EPA's core responsibility to protect human health. Ignoring the benefit part of a cost-benefit analysis would mean that the EPA could never justify any regulations that protect public health.
So health benefits, keeping people alive, doesn't matter, but how much money industry makes, that's the real benefit that the EPA will be judging from now on.
That's the idea.
Brilliant.
The Trump White House late last week announced its intention to withdraw the United States from over 60 international treaties, conventions, and organizations, including the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the bedrock international treaty that underpins the Paris Agreement and other agreements required for international cooperation on climate change. The Trump administration is also pulling out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN's leading climate science body. The White House says the UN treaties, quote, operate contrary to U.S. national interests. International law experts say Trump's unprecedented move is likely illegal. Gene Sue, senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, on a recent broadcast explained that with the world shifting to clean energy, withdrawing the U.S. from climate negotiations harms Americans' long-term economic well-being.
When you have the entire world and the global economy making those moves, U.S. suffers by being a pariah on that. U.S. consumers, U.S. citizens, we all suffer economically by being the odd man out.
And finally, a bit of good news. A federal judge on Monday ordered construction to resume on a large wind farm off the coast of Rhode Island after the Trump administration halted it and four other offshore wind projects already under construction.
Who's the loser now, Mr. President? For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on social medias, especially Blue Sky at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I'm a loser. I'm a loser, and I'm not what I appear to be.
Yes, he is, isn't he?
Yes, the more the better.
Yes, the more losing, the better for that man. All right, we got to get out. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, not a loser at all, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other since the beginning of time, you can download all of them for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button when you stop by Bradblog, or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves through these weird times. That's bradblog.com/donate. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. You'll find me on the social medias at TheBradBlog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
I'm a loser.